you sail 90 miles from Key West in Florida, you'll make landfall on the island of Cuba, run by a regime that America has never liked. And since this is the year of bombs, drones and talk of regime change, the island has not escaped close attention.
I do believe I'll be having the honour of taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba in some form, yeah. Whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth?
So, could Cuba be next? In what form? And what would that even mean for Cubans and Americans? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a history lesson. To understand Cuba's present, you need to understand its past. So let's go back to early 1959. After 5.5 years, the Cuban Revolution has succeeded, President Fulgencio Batista has fled, and Fidel Castro has taken charge. The good relationship between Cuba and the US is ending, as Lillian Guerra, Professor of Cuban and Caribbean History and the Director of the Cuba Program at the University of Florida, explained to me.
That is a year in which we have an extraordinarily popular, very effective, and almost electric movement of change through laws and decrees that begin to transform the economy, not in terms of communism, but in terms of making it a pro-capitalist economy that is nationalist, that has high barriers to American goods and to American manufacturers, that's really giving the opportunities to small businesses, to large-scale businesses in Cuba that they'd never had previously to 1959.
But
in February of 1960, the vice premier of the Soviet Union comes to visit Cuba, signs a huge $100 million trade agreement that is spun as an alternative to this kind of monopolistic trade that the United States had enjoyed and continued to somewhat enjoy with Cuba. He's there for 3 weeks, which is, one would say, a long state visit. In addition, we have a number of extraordinary things happening in civil society. So militias begin to take over what is Cuba's very vibrant free press, arguing that the editors and journalists are publishing articles too critical of the Cuban regime or that they're dupes of American empire. And so by May, they're all nationalized and the Cuban state suddenly is in control of the public discourse and the narrative and in control of the media.
Cuba's trading relationship with the US worsened as Cuba snuggled up to the Soviets. The Soviet Union offered Cuba cheap oil in exchange for sugar and other goods. In mid-1960, the Cuban government nationalized U.S.-owned oil refineries because they refused to process Soviet crude oil.
By December of 1960, you have a communist state in all but name that controls 80% of the economy. And in most respects, that's where we are today. I mean, today we still have a situation in which the Cuban government and its agencies, including the Ministry of the Armed Forces, own and directly control 80% of the economy.
This was the height of the Cold War, and the Americans weren't happy.
The U.S. closes the embassy in December of 1960, cuts diplomatic relations, and then in January and February imposes a unilateral trade embargo against Cuba. So the embargo made it impossible, and to a certain degree, almost till the present day, made it impossible for Cuba to trade with its closest neighbors. They're always under the threat of a possible imposition of tariffs from the United States. So Cuba had nobody to trade with except countries in Asia and the communist world, which would include the Soviet Union and China.
Then in 1962, the Soviet Union placed nuclear-armed missiles in Cuba as part of its deterrent strategy, allowed by a Cuban regime worried about a repeat of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of their island the previous year. The Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest the post-war world came to nuclear war, only strengthened the Havana-Moscow relationship.
From 1972 until 1991, Cuba was part of the Soviet bloc, meaning that it surrendered, I would say, a lot of its sovereignty over the economy, and tens of thousands of Soviet planners swooped into Cuba and began to manage Cuba's factories, sugar production, planned the economy.
And then suddenly, the Soviet Union collapsed.
The Cuban state was dependent on a currency that was pegged to the Russian ruble. And when the Russian ruble becomes part of the capitalist currency market after 1991, then the Cuban national currency is worthless. It becomes really island-only currency. And the Cuban state had virtually nothing in hard currency in foreign banks abroad. It virtually has nothing to make up for the deficit. And then it has no means by which to operate the machinery in Cuba that runs state farms for the production of sugar, let alone a place to sell its sugar. And so we have Cuba kind of going back to medieval times, people having to figure out how to live on wood and charcoal.
Something had to give.
There was virtually no food, so the Cuban government opens up the ability of farmers to start growing food for the first time and selling that food to the state so that the state can resource hotels. The Cuban government would turn to tourism and foreign investment, interestingly enough, as a way to salvage what was a collapsing, chaotic, catastrophic human and political situation. So foreign investors become the partners of Fidel Castro, who his entire life had demonized them.
In 2006, Fidel became seriously ill and he handed over power to Raul Castro because nothing says socialism like giving the job to your brother. Raul oversaw a reform program which led to the expansion of the private sector. And in late 2013, after more than half a century of troubled relations, a funeral led to an unexpected rapprochement.
Well, Nelson Mandela died. And when he died, Obama was at his funeral in South Africa. And Obama walked up to Raul Castro and shook his hand. And that was the handshake that really rocked the world. And in the aftermath of that, Obama really began a process of opening possibilities for Americans to travel to Cuba, unrestricted as they had been before, and just see it for themselves.
Nearly a year later, on December the 17th, 2014, Barack Obama and Raul Castro made separate, simultaneous announcements on TV, normalizing relations between the two countries.
The Obama administration did that with some stipulations about what that would mean. And there were pretty significant results almost immediately felt on the island, one of which was that the Obama administration wanted Wi-Fi and access to the internet to be part of this. For the Cuban people, it really was extraordinary. It brought them to the 21st century. So that was the beginning of the opening of relations that ultimately had enormous consequences.
Those consequences were temporary because in his first term, Donald Trump tightened up regulations on travel and trade. He also redesignated Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism in 2021. In recent years, Cuba's economic situation has significantly worsened for reasons that we're about to discuss. Lillian Guerra. Now I want to find out a bit more about what life is like for the ordinary Cuban today. Will Grant is the BBC's Mexico, Central America and Cuba correspondent. Will Grant, walk me through the streets of Havana. What do you see and what do you hear? And also, how have those streets changed in the last few months?
A walk through the streets of Havana is really where you see the effects of this oil blockade, and you do see it pretty much everywhere you go. The first and most obvious thing is the lack of traffic on the streets. There's simply only a fraction of the vehicles circulating on the streets of the city that there would be in a normal period of life for the island. You also see huge rubbish piles on street corners because the state-run fleet of rubbish trucks simply isn't doing its rounds. It's simply not picking up the rubbish anywhere near as much as it normally would be. And that's causing sort of a potential public health emergency, actually. But it's getting very, very bad and very, very problematic to the point that even at points, the public has set fire to these rubbish piles just to get rid of them. And of course, at times, particularly at night, it's very clear that there's no electricity at all. It's very dark. There are no streetlights working. There are no traffic lights working. So, you know, with schools also shuttered, businesses often closed, state-run offices closed, places of work closed, it really is a sense of a city in the dark, really.
Well, what about things like food?
Well, the food situation is becoming acute as well. People are sort of pushed into the black market to find basic goods, particularly obviously fuel, let alone food. But also it's just becoming extremely expensive to find the very, very basics. Even if you can find them, you're having to go to privately run shops to find them now, where obviously the prices are higher and higher and well out of the reach of most ordinary Cubans who must rely basically on some form of dollars coming in, whether or not that's through family members abroad or some access in the country.
And what about the situation in more rural areas?
The funny thing is that it's very difficult to get to them at this stage, of course, because as you know, as journalists, we also rely on what little fuel there is. So I did go when there was still the energy crisis in the island, but before there was this energy blockade. And there I saw people cooking with firewood, people going much longer than the capital was going without power. So the power cuts in the provinces can go on 18 to 20 hours a day. The thing is that under this fuel blockade, that is now true of Havana too, and has been for a while. So really, the situation is bleak across the island. But yes, it's particularly tough in the provinces.
Well, the picture you're painting is one that sounds really a bit like a country that's close to collapse, is it?
Donald Trump would certainly paint it that way. He continually talks about a country that is ready to fall, is about to fall, is failing. And in many regards, the key pillars of the Cuban Revolution are crumbling. Let's think about what they are. Healthcare, that is in trouble. The hospitals are struggling. Education, schools are often closed under these circumstances. But it has been in trouble for a while because, you know, 20-odd percent of the country has simply left.
20%? Since when has that happened?
It's really been over the past 5 years. Since the pandemic, things got much more pronounced in terms of the outward exodus. And there's been a route in which people have been able to do that. They don't need visas to go to Nicaragua, which is under a socialist ally in Daniel Ortega. And then from there, they traveled overland through people traffickers and migrant routes all the way to the US border with Mexico. So it's a long journey, but those who have the funds to do so have been doing that. And other people have been traveling to Spain because of changes in the rules in Spanish citizenship for people in the Americas.
Well, Fidel Castro was famously very charismatic. Tell us about the current president, who I imagine a lot of people here would struggle to name.
It's Miguel Díaz-Canel. Now, he was appointed by Raúl Castro, Fidel Castro's brother, when he was president and head of the Communist Party. And it was very much he was the chosen successor. They wanted continuity. He represented that. And that has really been his slogan, continuity. Of course, that's frustrating for ordinary people because what they enjoyed through the period of closening between Barack Obama and the Cuban government was the fact that it wasn't continuity, it wasn't more of the same. It felt new, it felt fresh, it felt optimistic and possible and exciting. And then Miguel Díaz-Canel is in charge, and suddenly it's back to the sense of continuity, of continuation of basically the same Cold War ideas with no sophistication to them, the same slogans that now feel hollow to ordinary people, to young people particularly. And then there's the accusation of hypocrisy in it all, which at a time like this, people feel very acutely that, well, we are suffering, we're being asked to make a sacrifice and to show resistance and to, you know, to, as it were, die with our boots on in the face of pressure from the empire over the Florida Straits. But you've got lights on in your home. I know you've got petrol in your car. I know you've got enough food in your fridge. And that disconnection between the political classes and the ordinary people is a very, very real experience in the revolution now and a real difficult one for the Cuban Revolution. Again, not solely related to these 3 months of the US oil blockade, an ongoing problem for the revolution, but definitely Miguel Díaz-Canel has not been an inspiration figure to the Cuban people and only really seems to galvanize that sector of it that still remains very, very revolutionary.
On the streets, are people talking about it?
It's all they're talking about, David. It's literally all that people are talking about in Cuba, as far as I can see. It's all the conversations I'm having when I see friends, when I see family members. My wife's Cuban-American. It is the only really thing on people's lips because it is the daily experience.
Will Grant, and before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, which includes the one on the Gaza peace plan and the one asking whether we've got public inquiries all wrong. Now, back to Cuba. Joining me in the Briefing Room are Hal Hodson, America's editor at The Economist, and Christopher Sabatini, senior research fellow for Latin America at Chatham House. The BBC's Will Grant has just described the current situation in Cuba. I want to go back a few months. When and how did this latest crisis start, Chris?
It started when the Trump administration, after several months' military buildup off the coast of Venezuela, on January 3rd, special ops forces went in and extracted the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife. And that's effectively when the embargo, if you will, or blockade on oil began. The Maduro government had been sending, at the time, about over 30,000 barrels of oil per day to Cuba. That had fallen from 100,000 barrels a day from the early 2000s. Cuba needed that oil. It's not self-sufficient in oil and gas to be able to basically keep the lights on. It was also reselling part of that oil on the international markets and getting hard currency that it was using to import food and medicine. When the Trump administration cut that off and then threatened a 50% tariff on any country or government that tried to replace that oil, and it was Mexico at the time, basically that source of oil dried up and the Cubans didn't have enough in storage and also enough inflow to be able to basically keep their lights on.
Right. Why is Donald Trump fixated on Cuba? What's the point of it?
I think the first thing for Trump is that Cuba is symbolic. Cuba is the symbol of communism on America's doorstep, and it has managed to last for 67 years in the face of the most powerful country on earth, with the most powerful military on earth, breathing down its neck, trying to get rid of that regime the whole time, and it's still there. And what does Trump like more than anything? It's to be able to say that he's the guy who did some big thing. And make no mistake, getting rid of the Castro regime in Cuba would be a big thing if he could manage to do it. The problem is that they're extremely good at resisting pressure from actors who are far more concerted and thoughtful and deliberate than Mr. Trump is.
Well, we'll come on to run that calculation in a moment. Now, we've heard, Chris, that an awful lot of Cubans have left the country since 2021, and a lot of those people have ended up in Florida via the southern border. Has that been a factor at all?
It's been a factor, first of all, historically, because to add to what Hal just said, there's a large Cuban-American constituency. Close to 2 million people live in the United States, and they're a very powerful voting bloc. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio, whose parents came before the arrival of Fidel Castro on January 1st, 1959, but his parents emigrated before, but he cut his teeth in the political hothouse, if you will, to mix metaphors, of South Florida politics. And so he really, for him, taking out the Castro government is really in his DNA, if you will, political DNA. So he's been pushing for this as well. And there you have a little bit of a contradiction. Donald Trump imagines something quick, easy, Venezuela-like, while for Marco Rubio, this is about promoting democracy and human rights. And those two are at odds. And so right now they're facing a real divergence in their own approaches and visions of Cuba.
Right, we'll see how that may play out. In the meantime, how Cuba's maintained good relationships with China and with Vladimir Putin's Russia. Is Cuba at all significant to those two?
I don't think Cuba is significant to them other than as a symbol of a sort of fly in America's ointment 100 miles from the coast of Florida. They do both support Cuba quite significantly. Just in the last couple of weeks, the first oil shipment in several months arrived in Cuba, allowed to pass the American blockade by Donald Trump. And that was in a Russian tanker basically sent by the Russians. And the Chinese have been supporting Cuba for a long, long time, in particular with the financing of large solar farms that have been popping up in Cuba extremely fast. There was a period to April 2025 in which Cuba was the fastest growing solar power entity on the planet.
Its
solar resources increased by a factor of 33 in 12 months. That's from a very low baseline, but that was all China. It's not enough to help it through this oil crisis, really, but it is helping some people keep their lights on a little bit longer. And you can kind of see a future that is a little bit less constrained by this oil triangle that Trump has trapped them in.
Chris, this is a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, to say you've got this oil embargo on Cuba, which is going to make the regime fall, and then to let a Russian tanker and some other people send oil to Cuba.
I think it was a recognition, quite frankly, that the Trump administration realized it had gotten into more than it bargained for. First of all, it wasn't about to force a confrontation with Russia, aside from the fact that obviously Putin and Trump are very close in some ways. I think they simply didn't have the stomach for both forcing a potential larger conflict with Russia, but also in denying Cubans oil. The situation is grave. And what was curious, too, was what went on then is Trump said, well, we'll decide this on a case-by-case basis. So he's showing his hand and saying, wow, maybe this isn't as easy as we thought.
One other important bit of context here is that America has been allowing a very small amount of oil to trickle into Cuba for quite some time now, a couple of months, as long as it is bought by private actors. And the way that this oil is getting into Cuba is extremely weird. It's going in, it's not necessarily oil, it could also be fuel, gasoline or diesel. It's going in containers, the standard shipping containers, packed in barrels or something like that, and then being distributed through private actors within Cuba. Clearly, some of it ends up with the government. The reason to say this is that the Americans have always had this idea of stringing Cuba along so that they're not just shutting it off and saying, okay, you're up against the wall, you're either going to have a humanitarian crisis and everyone in your hospitals will die because the power will go off, or you do what we want. They've never quite had the stomach for that. They have been stringing the Cubans along the whole time, and I see the Russian allowing the Russian oil to go through as kind of part of that pattern of, we're going to press you, but we're not going to really push you all the way to the wall.
If I can add, too, the idea of the Trump administration to allow for a steady trickle, and it's a trickle, of oil that would then be received and processed and distributed by the private sector really was kind of a red herring. The private sector isn't that strong. It's very small. And to give you an example, the gas stations across all of Cuba are owned by the military. And the Trump administration said that if this oil goes in, it cannot be handled or distributed by the state. So this trickle of oil, it's really mostly symbolic. It's not going to help those poor people waiting literally days in line to fill up their tanks.
Also, a question I do wonder, Chris, and when you talk about the private sector, which is permitted in Cuba, isn't that significantly also open to influence by organs of the state?
Yes. The private sector exists at the mercy of the government, basically. And a lot of the people that run the so-called private sector, and there are real entrepreneurs. If you go to Cuba, the paladares, the restaurants and the hotels, Airbnbs are real. But these are actually, many of them are the descendants of the Cuban revolutionary elite who've had the resources and the property to be able to open these up.
And all you need to understand is that all of the openings that have happened in Cuba have been done by the regime. The regime has sanctioned them and the regime has allowed them. The regime has set them up the way they want to set them up. They've often turned around and said, actually, we've changed our mind about this. So the idea that there's a sort of thriving private sector isn't true. But I think that the more black market the private economy gets, the more thriving and kind of open market it really is. And there is something to that. I don't think there's zero real private activity happening. Yeah. And the idea that that could grow, I think, is, to my mind, one of the more legitimate ideas that the Americans come with. It's been the idea for decades, right? Yeah. That the private sector grows and depowers the regime.
Chris, what do we know about talks between the Cubans and the Americans themselves? Are there direct contacts, indirect contacts? What's going on there?
Frankly, we know very little about the talks. They were rumored for a while. There were, I think, some false leads as well. But it looks like at the margins of the Caribbean Community Conference a few months ago, Marco Rubio did talk to the brother of Fidel Castro's grandson, nicknamed El Congrejo, Raulito, also little Raul, on the margins of the conference. And what's curious is the fact that Marco Rubio is talking to a Castro is really an odd turn, because they were enemy number one for Cuban Americans. In fact, the law that governs the U.S. embargo on Cuba specifically says no Castro can be in power for the embargo to be lifted. And then you turn around and have a Cuban American Secretary of State negotiating directly, not with just a Castro, but the grandson of Raul Castro.
Seriously, that is a condition. No one with the name of Castro, yeah, or of the Castro family.
Exactly. The Helms-Burton Act of 1996.
Oh, wow. But we've been talking about the Castros quite a lot. Can you tell us where the current president fits into all this?
The current president, Díaz-Canel, was a party apparatchik, actually cut his teeth politically in the interior of the country. He was really sort of nominated as a new generation member of the revolution, although he's in his mid-60s. But he really is just a placeholder. He's not a Castro. He didn't emerge from the guerrilla movements of the 1950s that really Fidel Castro sort of brought into the government when the past regime toppled. He's a colorless figure who really has no authority. They say he's pro-private sector, increasing market incentives, but he has shown no sign of doing that. He's really not much of a player, as I would say.
In other words, he's subordinate to the Castro family. He's there on their sufferance.
And to be clear, he was explicit that he's subordinate to the Castros when he was inaugurated, and he said, effectively, I defer to Raul for all important decisions.
Yeah.
That's just a fact. So this is not supposition. This is just the truth.
What about political opposition?
Cuba, again, is a one-party totalitarian state. It has penetrated all aspects of Cuban society and has shown no tolerance for political opposition. Those who have dared to raise their voice, in some cases there was a movement in the 1990s to engage in a referendum on the Constitution that was shut down. They do not tolerate any dissent. There are well over 1,000 political prisoners in jail right now. They have what they call committees for the defense of the revolution, which are neighborhood, if you will, sort of shock troops, civilians who call out and denounce and harass supposed opponents. It is a very stifled society and one that those who dare raise their voice pay a very high price.
The last time we spoke to you two was over Venezuela. And of course, it installed Delcy Rodriguez, who was the number two to Maduro, and she's still in power there. So when Donald Trump says he could take Cuba, what does he mean in your view, Chris? Does he mean I could install somebody like Delcy and calibrate what they have to do in order to please me? Or does he mean they're all out?
He means exactly the first, which is his thinking is he wants to use a colonial term. He wants a viceroy to his kingship, and this time in Cuba, someone who's compliant, who will do what he wants, who will not make waves. And this is, you know, this is the problem for Delcy Rodriguez and the Trump relationship as well, is, you know, he's completely cast his lot with Delcy Rodriguez. The last thing he wants, especially now given the events in Iran and the ramping up of to a destination unknown on Cuba, is that he doesn't want anything to rock the boat on Venezuela. And that's exactly what he would want in Cuba. Someone who could keep a lid and avoid any sort of disruption or chaos, but would allow him to say that he succeeded in securing some form of change and he taken Cuba.
One thing that seems to be coming clear, Hal, on that very point is that when it came to Iran, Trump took the most optimistic view possible about regime change. And Marco Rubio, amongst others, took a slightly less sanguine view. Talk us through that with relation to Cuba. Is Trump likely to learn from the Iranian experience that the Cuba might not be simple?
I think we can probably say it's unlikely that Trump will learn. I don't think that's necessarily the main point. The main point is that the Cuban regime is incredibly different from the Venezuelan regime. The Venezuelan regime is effectively non-ideological. It doesn't operate around a single family and the descendants of that family and their close confidants. It was possible to play different elements of the regime against each other in a way that I don't think it's possible when you're talking about a family that effectively runs Cuba, the Castro family. And the Cuban regime is ideological. It is a communist regime in a way that the regime in Venezuela just wasn't and isn't. The Venezuelan regime is far grubbier, just about making money illegally for various powerful people. And that's also, for sure, that's what the Cuban regime is about too. But it does have this, I think, real sort of underlying foundation of ideology that I think makes it much harder to cut a deal and separate one Castro from another or some lieutenant from a Castro. I think that's very hard.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Hal Hodson, Christopher Sabatini, Lillian Guerra, and Will Grant. And my conclusion? Let's wish the Cuban people luck. They may need it. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineers were Rod Farker and Neil Churchill, and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Johnny Diamond, and I'm the presenter of the Radio 4 series, How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians. We explore the complicated backstory of that Middle East conflict as the region endures another wider war. Through conversations with experts with a variety of perspectives, we travel back through the centuries to examine the history of the land that's now so contested between Arabs and Israelis, and we try and understand the past that's brought us to such a present. How did we get here? Israel and the Palestinians. Listen on BBC Sounds.